Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio has long been considered a bellwether state, which means that however Ohio goes in a presidential election, so goes the country. That may be changing. The New York Times reported on the trend last week. We're talking about it today. Joining us, Mike Dawson, creator of OhioElectionResults.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also, state representative, former associate publisher of the Columbus Dispatch and co-author of the highly regarded The Ohio Politics Almanac, Michael Curtin. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
And by phone, managing editor at the nonprofit political newsletter Sabato's Crystal Ball and author of The Bellwether, Why Ohio Picks the President, Kyle Condick. Welcome back, Kyle.
Good morning.
First of all, Kyle, how about the lexicon primer? Bellwether versus swing state versus battleground state, blah, blah, blah.
So a bellwether state is generally one that reflects the national popular vote in a given election. And as I write in the book, Ohio is the state that votes closest to the national average over the last 30 elections. These terms get thrown around a lot. A swing state can be a state that is just generally close in a given election, but a bellwether, I think, is sort of like a state that votes close to the national average, whether the election's a blowout or close. We haven't really had a blowout election in the United States in a few cycles. I guess maybe Bill Clinton in 1996 was the closest we've had in recent years, but, you know, a 20-point win like Ronald Reagan in 1984 is something we haven't seen in a little while.
And then there's the battleground issue, which means there's a lot at stake, right, Mike Curtin, the electoral votes?
Yes, there's only 8, maybe 10 states that are in play in any given presidential election. Ohio's always been in play for the last century plus, and because it has delivered a large number of electoral votes historically, it's a battleground state.
But those numbers are shrinking, the number of electoral votes.
They've been shrinking for the last 3 decades.
Right, right. Kyle, the title of your book says it all about why Ohio has in the past picked the president. Do you agree with the New York Times thesis that the factors in the Ohio equation are changing?
I do think that, so historically, Ohio has generally voted a little bit more Republican than Democratic. And so to the extent that Ohio deviates from the national average, it's usually in a Republican direction. I think that'll be the case in this election. Mm-hmm. What's new in this election and something to consider in the future is whether this education divide we're seeing amongst the white electorate in this election is something that persists, because Ohio's white electorate is a little bit less educated than the national electorate. And so if Donald Trump is truly going to bring a lot of non-college-educated white voters to the Republican camp and maybe push away some white college graduates, you know, if that persists over time, that might make Ohio more Republican. I will say that Ohio has voted has been about as good of a bellwether state in recent years as it has been at any time in its history. But it certainly seems like Trump will do better in Ohio than he does nationally. The question is by how much, and does that persist for non-Trump Republicans after him? If that is the case, then maybe Ohio is sort of trending away from being a bellwether, and maybe is more of a Republican state.
I think the interesting thing this election is going to be that Trump is going to get some traditional Democratic voters along the Ohio River, Mahoning and Trumbull County, mm-hmm. Ashtabula County, all the way down. And I don't know if that will continue on into future elections or if they'll go back to their normal voting behavior. I mean, Trump's going to do better there because the economy's worse there. Trade is a big issue there, whether it's a real factor or not. People believe it is. Immigration is an issue there, whether or not it's a real factor. But they believe it is. And so I don't know if that'll last beyond this one election cycle or not.
Right. Is it the candidates or is it that larger demographic makeup?
Well, it's both. I think Michael's right. I would agree with everything that Kyle and Mike just said. The other thing you have to look at, though, and this gets to the difference between bellwether and microcosm, you can be a bellwether while you slowly but surely are not becoming a microcosm anymore. And the biggest thing to look at in terms of Ohio losing its reputation as a microcosm is we're getting older, we're getting whiter, we're being less educated relative to the nation as a whole. And I would cite this statistic to show how the world has changed so much. In 1950, the year before I was born, Ohio accounted for 5.3% of the national population. in 2000, in the 2000 census, it had shrunk from 5.3 to 4% of the national population. In 2030, the U.S. Census is projecting Ohio will be 3.2% of the national population. We have a stagnant population. We're only growing incrementally while the nation is growing robustly. From 2000 to 2030, Ohio is projected to grow by 2 percentage points. The nation as a whole, 28 percentage points. Mm. So we're not capturing immigrants. We're not capturing appreciable numbers of Hispanics or Asians, and other states are. And so we are less and less of a microcosm year by year, decade by decade. Eventually, that has to be reflected in our politics.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about Ohio's bellwether status and other things that makes Ohio important in a presidential campaign or a presidential election cycle, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The bottom line is that Hillary Clinton doesn't need Ohio enough to get enough electoral votes. It doesn't depend on that largesse anymore.
It doesn't depend on – she doesn't depend on Ohio as much as previous Democratic nominees have.
She'd
because
like
other
it.
States have come into play that previously were not in play for Democrats.
Right. And that's because the other states are becoming more diverse and more populous than Ohio. Kyle Condit, is that what's happening? They're not only becoming more diverse – or I shouldn't say they're becoming more diverse, but they're reflecting the national diversity more accurately, and they're gaining in population.
Yeah, I think we've seen over the last few cycles that a lot of states along the Atlantic coast, particularly Virginia, which I think has already trended to become a state that's a little bit more Democratic than the national average. We're seeing sort of similar changes in North Carolina and Georgia. Florida used to be a much more reliably Republican state. It's been it's kind of a top battleground state over the last 15 years or so. And so, you know, Democrats are sort of – the Democratic coalition is sort of starting to move toward those states, and you wonder where do Republicans go to sort of make up those electoral votes over time. And it's probably to the Midwest, which is, you know, whiter and less diverse, whiter than the nation. So, you know, a state like Ohio has always been basically a necessary but not sufficient condition for Republican presidential victory. But then you also look at, you know, if the Republicans are going to make up for potential losses of states like, you know, North Carolina and Florida, well, then I think you have to think about them maybe adding states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin to their electoral coalition. Again, Ohio has always been crucial to Republican success, and I think it will continue to be so. But maybe you'll see some changes in the Midwest where the Republicans become, you know, have a better chance to win states like, you know, Michigan or Wisconsin. If they don't, and those Middle Atlantic or those states on the Atlantic coast become more Democratic, then really the Democrats start to have a bigger advantage in the Electoral College as you move forward.
I heard Arizona mentioned among those states that could be trending that way. And if that's the case, then Texas can't be far behind. I mean, that could be some huge changes. It's like a huge flip-flop.
You know, I caution people on Texas because Texas is becoming more diverse, particularly with sort of explosive growth of Hispanics. Mm-hmm. But one difference between the Mid-Atlantic states and Texas is that Texas is not bringing in the number of basically white-collar, young white-collar people from the Midwest to take jobs in that state. And that's there's kind of two changes that are happening in the Mid-Atlantic where they're becoming more diverse. They're also bringing in basically young Democratic liberal voters from other places in the country. In Texas, you just really – it's more of just the Hispanic growth but not necessarily bringing in a lot of the – you know, white-collar liberal workers from other parts of the country. And so that's a long way of saying I think the idea of Texas turning Democratic anytime soon is kind of far-fetched.
But Arizona?
Arizona is a different story. I think that I'd be pretty surprised if Trump didn't win it this time. And to me, there's not really much sign that the state is trending Democratic, but it is a state that's certainly more diverse than the nation, and is going to grow that way over time too.
The New York Times reporter wrote that this is a jarring change. That was their word, I think, for political veterans here who relish being at the center of the country's presidential races. And I'm wondering, Mike Dawson, is relish the right word in your opinion as somebody who's been observing for many, many years now? What are the advantages to being Ohio in previous national election cycles?
Well, I think it's an advantage if you like the attention that Ohio gets for about 60, 90 days in the last days before the election. And I think it's clear that we're getting less attention in this cycle than we have since I can remember.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to tell whether Hillary Clinton scheduled her appearance in Ohio after the New York Times story came out.
They're taking credit for it regardless.
But
yeah.
It looks awfully suspicious. The Clinton campaign is still spending a lot of money here on television. Yeah. They're still spending a lot of money on their ground game. So I don't think they've given up on Ohio. And I think she's probably going to win Ohio, but not by as much as she's going to win nationally.
Huh. And Mike Curtin, so why would that New York Times article spur her to visit? I'm not sure that was what spurred LeBron James to make his endorsement announcement necessarily, but
the New York Times is a New York Times. It
yeah.
sets a standard that people follow. And when the New York Times writes a piece like that, NPR picks up on it. The Times of London picks up on it. USA Today picks up on it. And it can become a repeating rifle storyline. And you don't want, like Al Gore allowed when he ran against George W. Bush, for that storyline to take hold and for basically people to think you're writing off the state.
Because we're so used to having people here all the time. I mean, there's lots of states that are written off all the time and they still vote and they still...
Well, Ohio is competitive and Ohio is going to be close. And I agree with Mike Dawson. I think Hillary is likely to win Ohio, but by a very close margin. And she can't afford to demonstrate that she's not working Ohio hard.
Yeah, and we haven't seen any polling since the first debate in Ohio.
Right.
Quinnipiac, if they follow their previous schedule, will be out later this week. We'll see what the debate, how it mattered. We'll also see Trump's latest rantings about the Miss USA pageant contestant and if that has any impact. And my guess is it's going to be closer this time than it was the last time. I think Hillary might be slightly ahead.
We're talking about Ohio as a bellwether or maybe an erstwhile bellwether state going, you know, this year. We don't know yet. We'll find out. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is clear, the numbers don't lie. Ohio is becoming whiter, less populous than the rest of the country comparatively. So that's what we're talking about. 614-292-8513. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio has long been a battleground and bellwether state in presidential elections. Bellwether because as Ohio goes, so goes the nation. And given the state's electoral votes, getting an Ohio majority has been critical. Now, not so much. It's still important, but is it critical? Maybe not. Now, Ohio seems out of sync or is out of sync with the rest of the country. It's lost electoral votes along with population over time as some southern states have become more diverse and populous. Still with us is Mike Dawson, creator of OhioElectionResults.com. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And state representative and co-author of the Ohio Politics Almanac, Michael Curtin. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And by phone, the author of The Bellwether, Why Ohio Picks the President, Kyle Condick. And again, Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's go back to that issue of how much of the change of status for Ohio is a function of this election cycle, particularly. Ohio is a losing population. It's less diverse than other states with growing populations. But the New York Times referred to this as a contest in which the electorate is sorted along bright racial and economic lines, which I thought was a pretty key comment, that it's all the more important. Kyle?
So Ohio Democrats have historically been reliant on getting a fair number of votes along the state's eastern border with Pennsylvania, and then along the Ohio River, so sort of the Appalachian part of Ohio. There are a few counties in northeast Ohio that are pretty overwhelmingly Democratic. Mahoning County, which is where Youngstown is, Barack Obama won it by 28 points. Trumbull County, which is the city of Warren, just north of Mahoning, Obama won it by 23 points. There is some thought that Donald Trump is going to improve so much in those counties that he might actually carry them. And just in three counties up there, Mahoning, Trumbull, and then Ashtabula in the northeastern corner of the state, Obama got about a 66,000 vote edge in just those three counties. He won the state by about 165,000 votes. So if Trump is going to dramatically improve in those places, because he's a different kind of Republican, that's a lot of votes, vote margin that Clinton is losing in this state that, she can afford losses up there, but if she, maybe even loses some of those counties, that's a challenge for her in trying to win statewide.
So I did a little exercise. I took the counties that Trump won in the primary and applied them to Romney's numbers and increased his percentages by 10% in those 31 counties. And that netted him an additional 177,000 votes. And as Kyle just said, Obama won the state by 166,000. So is it possible that Trump wins because he turns out people in those counties and wins by more than 10%? Yes. But he's going to perform softer in Republican counties, I believe, like Delaware, Warren, in some Medina counties like that, counties around Toledo. And so the question will be, will that softening of the Republican vote in those counties offset what he's going to gain in those other counties?
You mean when you say softening, you mean lower turnout?
No, he won't get – instead of getting 64% in Delaware County, will he get 58%?
Okay.
He'll still win Delaware County, but the percentages are going to be lower in some of those suburban counties and places like Upper Arlington here in Columbus and Dublin and Worthington, where you have highly educated, more economically well-off people. He's going to not do as well in those areas as Romney did.
Mike Curtin, in the New York Times article, you described Ohio as a melting iceberg that has slowly lost its bellwether status. When did the melt start? What was the turning point?
Well, it's been going on for decades now, and I would make the distinction again between microcosm and bellwether.
Mm,
we
yep.
clearly are losing our status as a microcosm. There's no question about it. All the demographic figures we've been talking about, it proves that we're less a microcosm decade by decade. Bellwether status will trail that by a period of time. We have been a bellwether up until the present day, and our ability to continue being a bellwether will be tested not only in this presidential election but in 2020 and 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is such an outlier. He is such an atypical candidate that if he carries Ohio, let's say, by a point or two, and yet Hillary Clinton wins the nation either slimly or by a lot, that won't be dispositive as to whether we've lost our bellwether status.
Gotcha.
We're going to take another election or two before we can resolve that. But my central point to the New York Times was, if you are slowly but surely and continuously being less reflective of the country on the demographic front, which we clearly have been, then it's only a matter of time before you lose that bellwether status. It will happen in time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Ohio's bellwether status. Just heard Mike Curtin describe how comparing it to a melting iceberg. It's happening slowly, but if it continues on that trajectory, it will happen. What do you think? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So if Ohio continues on this trajectory, Mike Dawson, what's in store for the Democrats? The New York Times, again, I keep going back to it. It uses such, you know, colorful language. It predicted a forbidding future.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, the interesting thing is we don't have state policy leaders really talking about how to reverse this trends that Mike Curtin so accurately described. And it's too bad in this presidential campaign.
You mean lowering the population?
All the things that are happening in Ohio,
yeah.
that are adverse, and what steps can we do to try to stop that slide? Because if we don't, as Mike said, you know, the next 50 years are not going to be well for Ohio, because mm-hmm. this trend is – you can just see this trend happening. And none of the candidates are talking about what we can do to make Ohio great again, to coin a phrase. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice if they were.
Yeah, it's Kyle Condit. I mean, on a couple different levels, this is it's troublesome. I'm depending on what side of the aisle you're from, or, you know, if you want to make Ohio great again, it doesn't bode well.
Well, unfortunately, you know, there are certain parts of the state that I think have basically been struggling economically since the late 1970s because of the decline of just a lot of heavy industry, particularly in the Northeast. I mean, I think you certainly can make that argument about the Mahoning Valley, but you know, there are positive stories going on in Ohio too, and I think Franklin County and the Greater Columbus area is a good example where you certainly have a lot of kind of 21st century employment. And a lot of, you know, major corporations and, you know, major public and private sector employers. But, you know, I think that this sense from particularly Trump, but I think that Democrats have pushed this message for a long time, too, that, you know, if we just had different trade policies or something, then all of a sudden we'd go back to the 1960s and we'd have, you know, massive steel production in Northeast Ohio and massive manufacturing. I mean, it just isn't true. I mean, you can't turn back the clock that way. That the world has just changed, and so then the question becomes, how do you revitalize the state? And really, it's not just an Ohio question. It's all along what you'd call the Rust Belt, from Western New York through, you know, Wisconsin and sort of the Midwest parts of the Northeast. You know, these are just long-standing, persistent economic challenges, and I don't think we're really addressing those things in this campaign. In fact, this is, you know, American politics can often be fairly content-free in terms of policy. This election in particular is really, really content-free, I think, given the two candidates, and also just the fact that I think that both candidates have had a lot of baggage, I'd say Trump in particular.
I didn't fully answer your question, and you asked me when did it start, and it's difficult to pinpoint, you mm-hmm. know, a year when it started. But clearly, if you look at the census data going back to 1950 and come forward, let's define the modern era as being post-World War II. Ohio was going very well through the 50s and 60s. It started tapering off in the 70s. The decline in Ohio's economic dynamism relative to the country was really noticeable in the 70s. And then if you wanted to pick a time when sort of a major hole appeared in the bubble, I would say it was the 81-82 recession. The 81-82 recession was the deepest downturn since the Great Depression. And you might recall that's when we saw a lot of the steel mills close in the Mahoning Valley. We saw a lot of the coal mines close up. We saw a lot of the traditional hard blue-collar employment centers in the Mahoning Valley and down the Ohio River Valley close up, and they didn't reopen. And then we had the impact of globalization, the impact of digitization, the impact of what it takes to compete in a knowledge economy. And it's been a trend since that if you don't have special skills, special education to compete in an economy that doesn't reward those old-time 1950s and 60s skills, you're going to lose dynamism, and Ohio has been.
Well, the most interesting statistic, I think, in Mike's book, The Ohio Politics Almanac, is in 1960, 51% of Ohio's jobs were based on manufacturing jobs. And in 2010, that had dropped to 13%. We're still making as many cars in Ohio as we did back then. We're doing them with far fewer people because of automation. Mm-hmm. And so there's been this change, as Mike said, in globalization and other things. But also automation has had a significant impact on manufacturing states.
Yeah.
Ann worked with me at the Dispatch for many, many years. And I tell people this story. When I joined the Dispatch in 1973, there were approximately 600 to 700 blue-collar workers, high-paid blue-collar workers in the press room, pressmen, engravers, you know, mailers, typesetters, all those folks. And by the end of the 20th century, it was down to 25 or 30.
Well, I was going to bring up the fact that in 1982, during that recession, happened to be the year I graduated from college, not 4 years after I started, by the way. But that was the first major contraction of the newspaper industry, too. I mean, significant contraction. There were no jobs. There was nowhere to get a job unless you had some kind of in, like delivering papers for the Columbus Dispatchers. But, you know, it was – and that's when it started, really.
The impact of high technology, robots, computers, running presses, running auto assembly lines, we still make incredible products, but with one-fifth to one-tenth of the employment base it used to take to turn them out.
Right. And going to the education piece, Ohio has not done a good job of educating everybody for the coming, the future.
Well, we've cut taxes by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, I think over $1 billion now, and we're not investing that in specialty education, in improving the workforce. And you're going to have to do that in order to change the tide that Mike has described.
Hmm. Kyle?
Yeah, Ohio's so nationally, about 29% of Americans over the age of 25 have a bachelor's degree. In Ohio, it's only 26. And you might think, oh, well, it's only a 3% difference, but that's a lot of people, mm-hmm. or you know, a significant number or more higher number of Ohioans who don't have a bachelor's degree, and that plays into this election because of. You know, there didn't used to be as big of a difference amongst whites with different education levels in terms of their political preference. I mean, both whites with and without a college degree were generally fairly Republican in recent elections. But in this election, you're seeing the college graduates trend more toward Clinton and the non-college graduates trend more toward Trump, particularly white men without a college degree. And, you know, that education gap really hits in Ohio just because there's a smaller percentage of white college graduates in the state. So it's a big deal politically in this election. And again, does it persist over time is really the key question.
Former Ohio Democratic Party Chair Jim Ruvolo in the New York Times article said that the Republican Party used to run on God and guns, and that Donald Trump has added a third element, trade, and that plays well in Ohio. And I guess I've thought for a long time the trade was a part of the narrative for a long time now. But it's more significance?
Jim's right and wrong. I mean, trade, the trade message of Donald Trump plays well with blue-collar workers who have lost jobs, who are just hanging on. But one in five jobs in Ohio, current jobs, are export-dependent, people who work in export-related industries. And so if you are a Republican-oriented business manager, a guy who subscribes to the Wall Street Journal and runs a business, or you're a middle-level executive at one of these firms that makes products that get shipped out of state or out of country, his message clangs. It does not resonate. So back to Kyle's point, you know, what the thing that's going to be so interesting on election night is to see how the former blue-collar Democrats Trump wins are offset by the upscale, highly educated, usually Republican-leaning voters who don't resonate at all with that message of his.
And who either don't vote or vote for Clinton.
They won't be voting for Trump.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, trade has now become a partisan issue. I mean, if you look at – it used to be that Democrats opposed – free trades and Republicans were free traders. If you look at the polls now, it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
And it's because of who the president of the United States is. Democrats are saying, well, we trust Barack Obama, so therefore we trust the TPP. Republicans are saying, well, we trusted George Bush, but we don't trust Barack Obama, so then we're against TPP. It makes no sense. I mean, as Mike just said, one out of every five jobs in Ohio depends on exports. And you have Donald Trump talking about putting 35% tariffs on, which would be devastating to the Ohio and the national economy. And everybody says, go get them. And we're against trade. I mean, without thinking about the implications of what that means.
Well, no one speaks up for free trade anymore. I mean, you've got, you know, Mike mentioned the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, not only does Donald Trump oppose it, but Hillary Clinton officially does, too. You know, President Obama supports it. There's some thought that maybe during the, you know, the lame duck session in November and December that Obama could work with the Republican Congress to pass TPP, although the chances of that seem fairly slim. But, you know, particularly in the Mahoning Valley, I mean, Democrats have been running on anti-free trade messages for years and years. I mean, Tim Ryan, who's a congressman from up there, Democrat, he won his seat in 2002 in part by kind of attacking then-Representative Tom Sawyer, who held the seat, on his vote for NAFTA back in 1993. And, you know, NAFTA has been demagogued like crazy in Northeast Ohio, yet as we mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of these job losses happened before NAFTA happened.
Right.
You know, they happened in the late 70s and early 80s during that really bad recession. So it can't be NAFTA's fault that those jobs went away, because they went away long before NAFTA was passed.
So the idea is that people want the trade deals to bring jobs back. That's not a reality. That's not part of what trade deals do.
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, and obviously there are many more jobs dependent on free trade than I think a lot of politicians want to admit. And it is amazing that if you look at the attitudes of Republican voters on free trade, they've changed, swung dramatically from being fairly pro-free trade as of just a couple years ago to being anti-free trade now. And I think the reason is that voters do tend to take on some of the beliefs of their leaders, and Donald Trump's the leader of the Republican Party right now, and Trump is very, very anti-free trade.
Well, both candidates are playing on the fears of Ohioans and other people nationally by demagoguing trade. It's a fear issue. And, you know, the reality is that globalization was going to cause a shift in manufacturing regardless of free trade pacts. I mean, the United States used to be the only one who made cars and made refrigerators and did it. Now you can make those things all over the world. So it's not a matter of a trade issue. It's a matter that other people can produce those goods now.
Yeah, globalization is not going to be slowed down. But you have to wage elections every 4 years and, you know, deal with people's fears and anxieties. And so we do get demagoguery. But whoever is the next president is going to be dealing with how to deal with globalization, and it's not going to be slowed down. And a lot of these jobs are never coming back. These coal mines are not going to reopen, no matter who the president is. And that's just a reality.
We'll continue our conversation, kind of looking at Ohio and looking at the issues that shape it, and also the demographics that shape and how it stands up in a presidential election year. Is it still a bellwether state or not, or is it at least heading in the direction of not? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio's status as a bellwether state. The New York Times last week reported that status is fading. Still with us, Mike Dawson, creator of OhioElectionResults.com, also state representative and co-author of The Ohio Politics Almanac, Michael Curtin, and by phone, the author of The Bellwether, Why Ohio Picks the President, Kyle Condick. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mike Curtin, Joe Hallett, in an article for The Dispatch wrote last week, it kind of gets to the issue of the contrast or the comparison between what a microcosm is and what a bellwether is. He said that the 12-county region of the northwest corner of Ohio is a sort of a microcosm or a micro bellwether is what I guess he would. He says the region's makeup of one big Democratic county, Lucas, offset by GOP farming counties on either side, create a bellwether within a bellwether. And I thought, and what he found ultimately was that it's still impossible to call. He still doesn't know who's going to win even there. But is that, I was wondering, is that, are we talking about that microcosm or are we talking about a bellwether?
Well, I think Joe is saying that Northwestern Ohio is as good a bellwether as there is within the bellwether of Ohio. That's okay. How I took that comment.
Yeah.
Northwest Ohio has been the closest to the statewide average in 6 out of the last 10 elections. Central Ohio has been the bellwether in the last 2 presidential elections. And Southeast Ohio, I think, was one time. So Northwest has been the traditional bellwether, although in the last 2 it's been Central Ohio.
So you're going to see that change. Kyle Condick, these bellwethers within bellwethers, what do you think?
So Hillary Clinton is going to be in Toledo today. And, of course, you know, we've been talking about how she hasn't been in the state in about a month, but mm-hmm. She decided to come back, and she's going to be in Toledo and Akron. I was in Toledo myself for some events about a week and a half ago, and I could tell you that a lot of people I talked to up there were very cognizant of the fact that Trump has been there with campaign stops, and Clinton herself has not. I think that Ohio voters can get kind of spoiled a little bit because they're used to seeing the candidates so much. But so there was actually a poll of Lucas County, which is Toledo, that came out late last week. And it had Clinton up by, I think, 27 points in the county. I think Obama won it by 31 or 32. So there were a lot of undecided. So I think that Clinton probably will do about as well as Obama did in Lucas County. But there are a number of other counties up there that are kind of swing counties right now. Wood County, where Bowling Green is, Ottawa and Sandusky counties. In fact, Mike Dawson found that Ottawa County has been the best sort of bellwether for the state. It's the only county in the state that has voted for the winner since 1964, the presidential winner, which is also what you could say statewide about Ohio too.
Yeah, Ottawa County is the bellwether in Ohio over the last 10 elections, but Sandusky County right next door has been the bellwether in the last 2 presidential elections for Ohio. So it's interesting. There's even bellwethers within the bellwether, within the bellwether.
This is like an Escher drawing. And so, again, a bellwether doesn't drive anything. It just reflects.
It's just reflective of the statewide, what happened to the statewide
right.
election.
And then, Kyle?
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting about So the 20 most competitive counties in Ohio over the last 4 elections, Ottawa, Sandusky, and Wood are 3 of them, but they're scattered across the state. A lot of them are in the eastern part of the state. But what's interesting is if you took all those counties out of Ohio and just sort of set their results aside over the last 4 elections, it wouldn't change the result of any of the last 4 elections. So because the very close counties in Ohio just tend to cancel themselves out. And so I think what these elections are about is making sure that, you know, for Democrats, it's getting base turnout in the 3 big cities, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and also in some of the other core Democratic counties. And for Republicans, it's really driving turnout in the rural counties and also in the very Republican suburbs. I mean, all the counties around Franklin County qualify, and that's where there might be a kind of a underreported problem for Trump in that, you know, Trump will win the counties surrounding Franklin, but maybe not by as big of a margins as even a Mitt Romney or John McCain did, and they, of course, didn't even win the state.
Irish in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey.
Is it Irish?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, good.
I was just wondering how you think this election may impact the socioeconomics of the state and the nation.
I'll try it first.
Yeah, Mike
Curtin. It's a good question. A lot less than the candidates would try to persuade you. If you look historically over how much control any president has over the direction of the national economy, it's fairly minimal. Same thing with the governor. Over the state, they do impact the economy at the margins based on the policies that they adopt. But in this increasingly global world of ours, there is so much outside the control of any president or any governor that it's a lot less than the campaigns would have you believe.
Well, I would argue that if you raise tariffs by 35%, as one of the candidates has suggested, that that's going to have a pretty big impact on the economy.
I was obviously assuming that that was could never get through Congress, but we'll see.
There's still Congress. Irish, I hope that helps. Thanks a lot. Anyone else have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the impact of the unions or the demise of the unions in Ohio, once heavy, hardcore, you mentioned, Mike, even in the newspaper industry, even in a place like the Dispatch, where the reporting staff was not unionized, but other parts of it were, that changes a lot about how you get out the vote in Ohio.
Well, the historic trade unions obviously are weaker now than they've been in our lifetimes,
right.
You know, whether you're talking about the steel workers or the mine workers or whomever, the printers are they're all, you know,
de minimis. The auto workers,
they're all pretty de minimis. Even in Ohio, the real union strength is in the public sector unions. And if you want to look at the private sector, I'd say it would be in the construction trades, which are still relatively healthy.
And the SEIU.
Well, and the SEIU, yeah.
Service Employees International, right.
Yeah, quasi-public sector union. But yeah, they also organize hospitals and a lot of nonprofits.
That's right. That's right. And does that show up in the numbers, Mike, or is it too early yet?
Well, I think in this particular election, because Trump is talking about trade so much in a way that Democrats respond to, that he's going to get a significant number more union voters than Republican presidential candidates have in the past.
Yeah. Huh. But, Kyle Condit, it's just a blip. I mean, it doesn't really mean much at this point.
Well, you know, I think it's been the case for a long time that the leadership of labor unions tends to be more unanimously pro-democratic than necessarily the rank and file. And actually, you could go back to 1968 when George Wallace was running as a third party kind of conservative Democrat. I think in a lot of ways there's some similarities to Wallace and to Trump. But there was, if you go back and look at news coverage of that 1968 election, there was all sorts of worry amongst labor back then that the rank and file was going to defect to Wallace, and some did, and probably, you know, never came back. But it's just interesting that, you know, that 50 years later, it's sort of the same thing. But I think that the campaigns are a little divided on how well they're going to do with labor. Some of the labor unions themselves see Clinton basically as strong as Obama was amongst union members in Ohio. There have been some other indications that Trump might actually be slightly leading amongst union members in Ohio. And so, again, in polling these subgroups, you can really get vastly different results. And so we're just going to have to wait and see how significant the inroads that Trump makes with union members are.
Mike Dawson?
Yeah, and Trump just picked up over the weekend the endorsement of the Cleveland Police Union. And
the Fraternal Order of Police?
I think it's called – it's not the –
the Cleveland Police Union.
Oh, yes. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, if he cuts into some of those votes, you know, that could help him.
In contrast to that, the Findlay newspaper?
Well, the Findlay Courier over the weekend published an editorial denouncing Trump. This is a paper which has had a Republican orientation for its entire history of nearly 180 years, and they published an editorial saying that Trump is a narcissistic television star turned snake oil salesman that nobody should vote for. Now, like USA Today, they stopped short of endorsing Hillary.
Okay.
But they're basically saying Trump's a disaster. He cannot be the next president. And it's interesting because this is a trend now we're seeing across the country in print journalism, both newspapers and magazines. It started with the National Review. You know, William F. Buckley Jr.'s iconic National Review, which back in the primary season published an entire edition titled Not Trump. and it was
during the primary season.
And then the founder of the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol, followed suit, and basically with Never Trump, you know, type of commentary. And in the last 2 weeks, we've had the Manchester Union Leader in New Hampshire endorse Gary Johnson, the Libertarian.
The Arizona Republic endorsed for the first time in its history.
The Arizona Republic, Dallas Morning News, Cincinnati Enquirer, Houston Chronicle, and San Diego Union Tribune, historically rock-red Republican newspapers, all endorsed Hillary.
So my question to the two former Dispatch employees is, what is the Columbus Dispatch going to do in this editorial endorsement?
As a former associate publisher, I am obligated to watch with interest.
Yes, and as a former editorial writer, me as well, I'm very interested to see how that comes out. And, of course, once you've done the editorial writing part of it, you look at every word, every paragraph, that kind of a thing.
Well, our friend, you know, since the death of John F. Wolfe, the longtime publisher, mm-hmm. and with the Wolfe family sale of the Dispatcher. This is the first presidential election since the Wolfs acquired that paper in 1905, in which that determination will be made by not an owner but an employee of the paper. Not to put Glenn Scheller on the spot, but our friend Glenn, the editorial page. No pressure, Glenn. I mean, Glenn's essentially going to make that call, and I think he's thinking he's going to make it, he's going to publish it, and he's going to run for the hills.
Yeah, regardless. Chico in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chico.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I would like to mention I have a point. I would like to share it with you. Okay. As an immigrant graduate here, I do feel there is about 60,000 to 50,000 immigrants. They are eligible to vote, and those, they believe very a significant role last time, 2008 and 2012. And the number is being grow up to 15% to 20%. By me saying that, as immigrant people, I see that they're leaning in the favor of Hillary Clinton. Right now, we show the ball is not like Hillary is behind, because those immigrants, they don't go like to the survey or online vote. And that's number when it comes to the what there is going to be changing guarantee. And most of those graduate student or undergraduate student mm-hmm. are based on immigrant people, they align in demographic side.
Okay. Okay.
There's Mike a story in the New York Times today about organizing in the Ohio State area. And there was no enthusiasm whatsoever for Hillary Clinton. I mean, the guy couldn't get anybody to vote, register to vote,
right?
And couldn't find anybody who was really interested. I think the press kind of overplays the university vote to begin with. It's not that much. But
right.
that lack of enthusiasm, I think, is real and is a real problem for her.
Well, you know, Ohio does have, you know, many big universities, including, of course, Ohio State. But, you know, Ohio University is part of the reason why, you know, Athens County in southeast Ohio is really the only reliably Democratic county in that part of the state anymore. And not only is enthusiasm potentially down at some of these universities, which could suggest lower turnout, but also some national polls are suggesting that the youngest voters are the likeliest to defect from either from Trump or for Clinton to vote third party, to vote for the Libertarian Gary Johnson or even for Green Party candidate Jill Stein. I mean, I would imagine actually that Jill Stein's best county in Ohio will probably be Athens, which I believe was true for Ralph Nader in 2000. And, you know, if enough of those young voters defect, I think that's a problem for Clinton, because basically, you know, this is a gross oversimplification, but essentially the older you are, the likelier you are to vote Republican at this particular time. And so she needs, you know, she needs to be solid amongst those youngest voters, and she's still got some work to do in that department.
Yeah, the interesting thing will be Gary Johnson will not appear as the Libertarian candidate on the Ohio ballot.
Right.
He will have no party next to his name, and whether or not that causes that vote to be less than if you had the word libertarian or not.
Hmm. Yeah, that's going to be
historically, these third-party candidates usually do a little better in the polls than they do on Election Day.
Right.
Mike Curtin, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you, Ann.
Michael Curtin, Ohio House of Representatives, member of the Ohio House of Representatives, and co-author of the Ohio Politics Almanac. Also, Kyle Kontick on the phone. Thanks to you, Kyle.
Thank you.
Kyle Kondik is the author of The Bellwether, Why Ohio Picks the President, and Mike Dawson, creator of OhioElectionResults.com.
Thanks
again. And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.